This is Growth Minded Milwaukee, powered by WTMJ Mobile.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Episode 7 of Growth Minded Milwaukee, powered by the WTMJ Mobile platform. The podcast is available on WTMJ.com, the WTMJ Mobile app, iTunes, SoundCloud, and YouTube. I'm Todd McCleese, founder of Pendio Group in Milwaukee. We help companies optimize customer acquisition and customer retention. The systems we develop make your revenue growth more predictable, and that's a key ingredient to increase the growth rate of your business. On this show, my job is to dig into the minds of all sorts of top performers who can help you understand what it takes to get your business or your career to the next level. They might be business leaders, community leaders, entrepreneurs or investors in the Milwaukee region, or thought leaders and subject matter experts from anywhere in the world. The most important thing is that you walk away from each show with something to use that enables growth. I want to say thanks for taking the time to tune in for Episode 7 of Growth Minded Milwaukee, which features Stephen Kotler. He's a New York Times best-selling author, an award-winning journalist, and the co-founder and director of research for the Flow Genome Project. When it comes to understanding how to maximize human performance, there's no better resource than Stephen Kotler. He's one of the world's leading experts in high-performance, disruptive technology, and innovation. That's why organizations like the U.S. Naval War College and Special Operations Command, Cisco, and Google, they look to him as an advisor. He's also the author of 8 books, including Bold and Abundance. In 2013's The Rise of Superman, which is the first time I became familiar with his work, Stephen brought the term flow state into the minds of people like me who are constantly looking for a performance edge. Being in flow describes a time when you feel your best and perform your best. People in flow experience heightened creativity, increased performance, and accelerated problem solving. In the book Stealing Fire, which was just released in February, Stephen and his partner in the Flow Genome Project, Jamie Wheel, delved into other performance-enhancing altered states of consciousness that people have been chasing since ancient times. So if you're looking to increase performance or find a competitive edge, this is the episode for you. I hope you enjoy the show. Without further ado, here's my conversation with Stephen Kotler. We're joined on Skype by Stephen Kotler. Stephen, thanks for doing the show. It's great to talk to you.
Totally my pleasure to be with you.
You know, nobody spends more time researching high performance and the impact that neuroscience plays. How long ago would you say the science behind human performance really began to accelerate?
So if you're looking at, you know, kind of the science of kind of altered states of consciousness and their ability to amplify performance, It actually dates back to the 1870s. And William James, turn of the century, 1900, godfather, founding father of American psychology, philosopher, physiologist, taught at Harvard, wrote the first psychology textbook in English, was poking at all these same questions and came to, by the way, many of the exact same conclusions that we reached in Stealing Fire. We then took a 100-year detour around kind of James's ideas, And the neural imaging technology started to come online in the late 90s. There's an open debate. What came first? Was it maybe Richard Davidson's, some of his meditation studies at University of Wisconsin, looking at these questions, or Dr. Andrew Newberg at the University of Pennsylvania, looking at why Buddhist meditators and Franciscan nuns have this experience when they meditate of becoming one with everything. He wanted to know where that came from in the brain. And both of those experiences got decoded at a pretty good level at that point. So that's really where it started. For me personally, when I was writing my second book, West of Jesus, I got to know Dr. Andrew Newberg, and it was his conclusions in that research that played a very pivotal role in that book and really sort of cemented me out in this path.
You know, you mentioned Richard Davidson at the University of Wisconsin. Having a Wisconsin-based podcast, I was interested to learn that you're a Badger. Have you kept in touch with him or worked with the neuroscience department at UW or Center for a Healthy Mind in Madison?
I have followed it from afar. I have not worked directly with it, though I am not just a Badger. I'm a very proud Badger.
Great.
I got a deep fondness for my time in Madison and how it shaped my thinking and myself as a writer. but I have not. And you know, I like my degree is not in science. Let's not kid ourselves. I came out with a degree in creative writing. I'm trained as a novelist. I'm actually trained as a poet who switched to novel writing my senior year in college to write my thesis as a novel. You know, I've got, though they don't officially grant these titles, I have something of a minor in philosophy and a minor in art in terms of credits. But they also told me that, you know, while I can claim that, they don't actually put that on transcripts, so I've never said it out loud until now.
The first time I read a book that you wrote was just a few years ago with The Rise of Superman. And it opened up my mind in terms of flow states, and I went back and read Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi and so forth. And I've gotten to the point now where my 21-year-old son pitched 6 shutout innings this weekend, and I said, how'd that feel? And he said, Dad, I was in flow the whole time.
That is a great story. It's one of the reasons I wrote Rise of Superman, right? I wanted people to have a language to talk about these fantastic experiences they were having. Mm-hmm. So good.
Can we level set on that just a little bit? Can you talk about flow states? Because it seems to me that Stealing Fire is just a natural evolution from where you were a few years back.
Yeah. You know, they're, all the books build on one another, and they're all built around a central question that I've had since really I became a professional writer in the early 90s, which is, what does it take for individuals to do the impossible? And when I first started asking the question, I was looking at action sport athletes who were routinely accomplishing so-called impossible feats. Things that, you know, a few months before people said would never be done. And, you know, not being a professional athlete and spending a lot of time chasing professional athletes around mountains, I broke a lot of bones. And after, after a certain period of time and a lot of surgeries, I realized that I was going to have to take my question into other domains. So I looked at business, I looked at finance, I looked at all those things. But the answer and what Rise of Superman ended up being about is the fact that it doesn't actually matter where you look. In all of these domains, ultimate human performance, right? What does it take to be our best when it matters most? Or what does it take to like kind of level up our game like never before and really do the impossible? Has a signature, and it is a state of consciousness known to researchers as flow. You know, if you're not familiar with flow, you may call it runner's high or being in the zone, being unconscious. It refers to those moments of kind of rapt attention and total absorption. You get so focused on what you're doing, everything else vanishes. Sense of self disappears, time passes strangely, and all aspects of performance, both mental and physical, go through the roof.
In the past, I've heard you cite the decade-long McKinsey study about increased executive performance. Can you speak to that a little bit and some of the other compelling data that you've come across in your work with Jamie Wheel at Flow Genome Project?
For sure. The first thing that was really got hard and solidified was Csikszentmihalyi's work, right? And I always say, he came to 3 or 4, depending on how you count them, really big, important conclusions, right? The first thing he figured out is, hey, this state of consciousness that we call flow is measurable. It's definable. It's got these 10 core characteristics, uninterrupted concentration, vanishing of self, time dilation, et cetera. And, you know, they built a very robust psychological questionnaire for it alongside a woman named Susan Jackson that, you know, is extremely well validated. He also figured out flow's ubiquitous, right? Shows up in anyone, anywhere, provided certain initial conditions are met. And then he figured out that it's fundamental to well-being and overall life satisfaction, conducting one of the largest optimal psych studies ever done and discovering that the people who had the most flow in their lives tended to score off the charts on tests of overall well-being, life satisfaction, meaning, purpose, all those, you know, really important categories. And from that point on, two questions were asked, right? Where is it coming from? So what's the neurobiology? What's the neuroscience? And we made enormous progress on that, I think. And how optimal, right? Like if we're calling it optimal human performance, can we measure what we're talking about? Mm-hmm. So a lot of different people have looked at it from a lot of different angles. McKinsey, as you referenced, looked at productivity in top executives. And after kind of a 10-year study, found that top executives in flow report being 500% more productive. DARPA found out that soldiers in flow learned 470% faster than normal. A variety of creativity studies, including some done by the Flow Genome Project, have measured the burst to a 400 to 700% burst in flow. And that heightened creativity seems to outlast the state by a day or two. And that's not mine. That's Teresa Mobley's at Harvard, that last bit. On and on. They've looked at a bunch of different metrics. We don't have really good numbers around cooperation and collaboration. We know from all the research into group flow that it really boosts these elements. We don't have great numbers around them yet. Mm-hmm. But that's like the McKinsey stuff falls into the category I think of as kind of how optimal. And the final part to the question you asked is what have we been doing? And a lot of what we did was we took these top performing organizations and individuals, top action adventure sport athletes, Navy SEALs, you know, CEOs of extremely high performing, big thinking, future forward companies, et cetera. And we took their experiences with flow, took all the neuroscience that had been done and have tried to work backwards towards flow triggers. And we found that flow has 20 preconditions that lead to more flow. And they're very, very trainable. And that's the thing. I think our biggest contribution is we took these ideas about triggers, some really well validated, some, you know, came out of our research, but not yet validated. And then we open sourced the research and we ran, for example, a joint learning project with Google about a year and a half ago, where we trained 60 different executives from all walks of the company, from engineering through, you know, marketing and sales, up in 4 high performance basics and 4 of flow's triggers over a 6-week period. And the data is just really incredible. What the data shows is we can get a 35 to 80% increase in incidences of flow, quality of focus and decision making, and a number of other really important categories. So what our research is really pointing at that's so exciting is not only is this stuff trainable, but at least, you know, early results, that's very easily trainable. There are open questions to how sustainable is that training, right? Mm-hmm. What does it look like 5 years down the line, 10 years down the line? Open questions still, right? We're still poking at this. We'd like a biophysical-based flow detector to help us measure more accurately. We'd like a lot of stuff. But right now, we've been focusing on, you know, kind of getting some of the research a little bit forward training people up in this stuff in all walks of life. And so that's been, you know, what we've been doing and where we've been having our fun.
Does it feel like it's going faster, like you're getting there at an accelerated rate over the last year or two?
So if you ask me on a personal level, you know, why did I write Rise of Superman? You know, there's lots of different reasons, right? I wrote it to help establish a common language for flow so we could have conversations like this one and other people could, you know, for the ideas. And what I really was hoping for was I wanted to get to the next set of questions. The stuff that was going on in flow research had sort of dried up in America, and the questions that were being looked at in Europe were much more like nitpicky psychology questions that certainly things we wanted to work out. Mm-hmm. But to me, it was like you're splitting hairs when you can actually talk about neurobiology and talk about mechanism. Talking about how this stuff makes us feel and which category does it actually slot in, et cetera, et cetera. I like, okay, but let's get to the next set of questions, right? And that's starting to happen. There's really Adam Ghazali at UC San Francisco, Scott Barry Kaufman at the University of Pennsylvania, among many others. These are guys who are asking the next question at really like deep, great levels. So that's being done. I can't tell you how many PhDs, master's theses, even high school papers have been written on these topics. And, you know, judging by kind of membership in kind of Flow Hacker Nation, the Flow Genome Project stuff, you know, I think we've got 80,000 people who are, you know, actively pursuing and, you know, our open source experiment and ultimate human performance. So we've become one of the largest open source research projects in the world, especially looking at ultimate human performance. And a lot of brains are on these problems right now. And that's so, you know, I'm thrilled. And that's, you know, that's what I think is happening. So, yes, it's speeding up. And also, as you know, if you're familiar with Stealing Fire, the book I wrote with Jamie, our most recent one, we talk about 4 forces, technology, psychology, neurobiology, and pharmacology, that are all sort of accelerating on exponential growth curves, meaning they're sort of standing on the backs of Moore's law, and so they're moving, you know, as fast or sometimes faster than our computers are, that are driving this stuff forward and really, you know, giving individuals much more choices, access to them on demand, kind of ways to navigate and not sort of derail along the way, and things along those lines. And that's happening faster and faster. So I think the next 10 years are going to be really pivotal and really interesting.
Can we dive into that just a little bit? I consume Stealing Fire in about a weekend. And
that's nice of you to say.
Well, it's really compelling in every chapter, right? There's so many things to ask about. But let's focus on those four forces for a second, because one thing that I've struggled with here in the Midwest, in Milwaukee, and I'm curious about your approach to this, pharmacology, it's tough to talk about microdosing without sounding like Timothy Leary.
Amen.
Yeah. Okay, great.
Yeah. It is, we struggled with so many things. Like, for example, you know, in the book, we reintroduced the Greek term ecstasis, right? Which means to stand outside oneself and to kind of tap into a state of heightened inspiration and information as the category for all the states of consciousness we were interested in exploring, right? Like, which was it's a bandwidth from meditative and contemplative states through psychedelic states, through flow states, which all share under the hood similar neurobiological properties. They all make us feel very similarly. And there's an explosion. There's been an explosion in psychopharmacological research over the past 5 years. We've seen tremendous medical applications of these technologies. Mm-hmm. Their ability to heal trauma and anxiety, you know, in every possible, under every possible condition, that some of these substances are showing for treating addiction or intractable problems like OCD. Really amazing research from the medical side. And we are starting to see research that was really done back in the 60s, but because it happened in the 60s, we don't trust it. So a lot of what's happened, you know, over the past 10 years is we've reproven things that we learned back then. You got to remember that SSRIs, which is what we take for psychological problems right now, basically work with the serotonin system. They're not very good at it, but they do work with the serotonin system, and there's lots of side effects. And what they really do is kind of calm you down. They don't seem to really boost performance, but in certain people, they can calm you down and you know, give you some help with anxiety and depression, for sure. But it's a limited population that responds super well, and there are a lot of side effects. Turns out psychedelics impact the same system, and if you microdose, right, you take sub-perceptual doses, you can impact that system without too much impact on cognition, right? You feel like you've had a bunch of cups of coffee. Mm-hmm. You're awake, you're alert, but you're not having any psychedelic experiences. But the internal machinery is, and you're getting, James Fadiman discovered consistently, a 200% boost in creativity. And we met. Now, you may not be having the conversation in Milwaukee, and I will jokingly, lovingly say, I think you're talking to the wrong people. Mm-hmm. And the reason I say that is we have been everywhere. And by the way, just coming back off of, you know, 3 months on the road, essentially, for Stealing Fire, and everywhere I went around the country, pretty much the first question I get was about microdosing. It's what everybody wants to know about. And it's because it's impacting the same serotonin system that, you know, SSRIs are. They've been shown to be, you know, non-habit forming. And unless you have proclivity for schizophrenia, there's no real danger. Yep. The FDA is in schedule 3 trials with MDMA for treatment of PTSD. Mm-hmm. They've started phase 1 with MDMA for treatment of depression and anxiety. So the government is moving in this direction. We're seeing high-performing organizations really moving in this direction. And then there's, you know, Tim Ferriss and many other investors in Silicon Valley, you know, are not only, you know, outwardly advocating for this stuff, but they are really investigating how to found, you know, essentially psychedelic-based medicine that focuses on high performance, right? As we talk about in Stealing Fire, right now, our medical system is designed to get you back to zero. It's really what it does. Mm-hmm. And, you know, nothing about it says, nobody bothers to say, hey, wait a minute, these same things that can get you from broken and really subpar up to normal can help you go from normal to really like up towards Superman. But that's what people are starting to look at. They're starting to realize this is true. And, you know, we are a performance productivity based society. And right now, the critical skills we need in the 21st century, creativity, collaborative skills, those sorts of things, to really unlock the levels of performance that we're capable of, you need to switch off normal waking state consciousness. You need to start tapping into these, you know, kind of extraordinary, non-ordinary states. That's the very tool that kind of evolution designed for us to solve these particular problems. We know that now. The research is pretty clear. And, you know, we're getting to the point where I think culture is starting to normalize slightly around this. How long is it going to take is an interesting question. And in my third book, A Small Furry Prayer, I kind of looked at like how empathy and perspective and these things expand in culture from kind of year to year a little bit. And that's, you know, on a certain level, what we're looking at here. And it's interesting. And I'm not saying there won't be a backlash. What we are seeing, and this is why, you know, pharmacology is not just an accelerating force, is there's an open source movement here.
Now, I want to say that the first time I heard you on a podcast, it was on Dave Asprey's show. And of course, he's taking the world in the direction of bulletproof coffee and cognitive enhancing nootropics.
If you've heard me talk about Stealing Fire at all, you've heard me say we sort of stumbled upon this revolution, right? The book is about a $1 trillion underground revolution and people hacking consciousness to massively increase performance. And we were doing work with Flow. We were running around the country kind of training up organizations in Flow. And I got to tell you the truth, when Rise of Superman came out in 2013, I thought this was kind of shocking that business, mainstream business, was interested in kind of the theory and practice of an altered state of consciousness for improved performance. That struck me as wild. But everywhere we went, people were using all these other techniques. Dave Asprey is a great example. He's built a revolution around kind of stacking neurotropics and cognitive interventions on top of cognitive interventions to, you know, heighten focus, amplify our access to these states, all kinds of stuff. We, you know, 44% of American companies are going to roll out meditation programs this year. Yoga is a $28 billion industry. You can do all these same things that, you know, we're talking about questions of pharmacology right now. Okay, that's, you know, we've got a 5-year window because 5 years from now, we've already got technology that can induce most of these states of consciousness, right?
Yeah,
and
so I've got
really weird ones, right? We talk about there's virtual reality technology that can induce mystical experiences. So we know what causes an out-of-body experience in the brain now.
Yeah, I've got to ask you about that. The neurotheology, the bit on Unity, that was one of my favorite portions of the book. But in addition to that, the doppelganger effect through
Is that not VR. The craziest?
That's crazy.
The fact that, like, yeah. So can I unpack that for your listeners just because it's so cool?
Yeah, please do.
All right. So at the top of the hour, right, when we started this conversation, I said that 1997, Andy Newberg says, why do we feel one with everything? Where does that come from? And using really early high-powered brain imaging technology, so something called SPEC, that we don't actually use much anymore because you have to shoot a radioactive dye into your veins before you take the picture. But it was very good for his experiment. He figured out that When people experience this feeling of oneness with everything, it's the part of your brain that helps you navigate through space, that shuts down, gets really quiet. And when this part gets quiet, because it helps you navigate through space by drawing a boundary around the self, this is where you end, this is where the rest of the world begins, so you don't bump into people or furniture or whatever. Most people don't realize that's sort of a flexible boundary, but we have this experience all the time. Blind people can kind of touch the sidewalk through their cane and feel the sidewalk. Tennis players will feel the ball through their racket. Skiers will feel the kind of the snow through their skis, right? We extend our senses all the time and we're built to do this. Andy Newberg discovered that part of the brain just gets really quiet. We trade off extra energy for focus and attention that we use in prayer and meditation. And this part of the brain isn't critical because you're not moving through space, really, you're meditating. So it can get really quiet. And when this happens, we can't separate self from other. We become one with everything. And part of that process takes place in a place called the kind of the right temporal lobe, which we've known since the 50s. You stimulate it with electrical current. All kinds of strange things happen. You can have out-of-body experiences. You can have near-death experiences. You can feel sense presences, gods or deities in the room. You can have visions, hear voices. All kinds of stuff happens when you stimulate this part of the brain. And it's because a lot of things come together there. And when you start breaking it apart, they separate in very weird ways. And one of the ways that they can separate is this part of the brain, besides making us feel one with everything, it can also project another version of ourself, right? You can project our sense of self outside ourselves. Sometimes you know, when it doesn't have a visual and it's just like consciousness floating outside yourself, you call it an out-of-body experience. Sometimes you actually get a vision of your double floating outside yourself. It's called the doppelganger effect. It can show up. Certain forms of epilepsy in the right temporal lobe will produce this. And you can, Kabbalistic Judaism figured out a way to do this intentionally. And they treated the doppelganger like a soothsayer. And they would ask the doppelganger questions and get answers. And what researchers in Jerusalem, like the one of the world's leading Kabbalist experts, teamed up with a neuropsychologist, the Hebrew University in Jerusalem, and they figured out what in the Kabbalistic kind of formula was producing this. And then they found a way, you know, then they tested it out, and then they found a way to duplicate the experience inside a virtual reality. Which is really interesting. So what this actually means, and where this gets super interesting, is over the past 20 years, we have pretty much decoded almost every so-called mystical experience you can think of. We haven't answered one of the bigger questions. We still don't know, you know, if there's a God or if there's not a God. We just know we're hardwired for these very strange experiences, and that, you know, they're very, very useful. Like, they may feel, we may have an out-of-body experience, but when you're having that experience, you're also tapped into levels of inspiration and insight that you don't normally gain access to. And that's very useful. And the same thing happens in all these other mystical experiences. And we're starting to get to be able to reproduce them with technology. So questions we're having about pharmacology right now, right? And it's hard to talk about it in Milwaukee. Okay, I get that. Makes sense. But what happens when it's 2022 and that experience shows up via an EEG headset?
Right. Yeah, speaking of EEG, I'm what one might consider an early adopter on all the technology, neurotechnology gadgets that are commercially available. So,
ones do you like best?
Well, I'm a huge fan of Muse. It really helped me with a contemplative practice over the last couple of years. I mean, it, you know, call it the gamification or just the quantified self.
I love Muse. There's, you know, Ariel Garden is a friend of mine. She was at our very first Flow Genome Project event. She came. I really like her work. I really think it's a great headset. We've worked with a number of different ones, but I think, you know, I agree with you on the consumer side. I think it's wonderful.
Just a couple of months ago, I started vagal nerve stimulation with the Nirvana. Have you tried this? It's a music modulator.
I haven't. I've heard of it. What do you think?
I think that doesn't help me calm down in that mode, but in the euphoria stage, I have to admit that you know, the right house music along with vagal nerve stimulation is an automatic for me.
So, So here's my question. Is it nothing I've read, which is not to say not possible, it's just nothing I've seen published on this question or talked to about experts, says that you can reach the vagal nerve just through specific music, right? You happen to really like house music. And certainly, you know, that, you know, music has a calming response, has a fire me up response, has alters consciousness, as we document, you know, really in Stealing Fire in a lot of different ways. So are you sure it's not just the house music?
Plus a little placebo effect from what the vibration in your left ear is supposed to produce. And so that's completely possible. Absolutely.
I'm just curious because it makes sense, right? It's a wave and you're impacting a nerve, which, you know, is certainly sensitive. Like, I can see it sort of mechanistically, like in my head, it kind of makes sense, you know, at that level. I'm just, you know, I again, that's why we advocate open source approach.
Yeah, like, no, totally. That's perfect.
10,000 people come to me with, you know, and I hear the same thing. I start to go, okay, let's take a closer look.
Yeah. So Fisher Wallace, or let me back up. I've heard you talk a lot about transcranial direct current stimulation and the tangential
and
technologies.
By the way, I used a Fisher Wallace device. I've got one. I spent 3 months on one of their kind of anti-anxiety settings to see, basically to improve meditation. Right. It was sort of a little experiment. I was going to write about it. They hadn't gotten all of their research in order, and it was just too slow. And I think I got distracted by a book. So it never happened, but I did run the test, and it was, you know, on a really low grade, you know, this is not transcranial anything stimulation really.
Okay.
It's really low grade. Obviously it's a low current It's, you know, not very much individually customized or any of the things that the research is showing is useful with these devices, but I found it calming. I really, I did. And I, by the way, is it placebo because I had electricity kind of buzzing through me? I don't know, but I did find it calming after 3 months. I was like, okay, it really actually deepened my meditation practice. And I managed to stretch very calmly without like no anxiety, not trying. I went from a 7 minute daily meditation practice to a 20 minute practice with ease and without like, you know, I could keep my mind pretty focused and pretty calm for that period. And I thought, you know, as a beta test result, instead of M to one, right? I thought it was pretty good.
Yeah. I've seen skeptical articles about Muse and its accuracy and so forth. So I guess some of this is what works for you, right?
Well, so my difficulty with all this stuff has always been the same, which is some of this stuff we just can't measure yet. So people making claims about neurochemistry make me a little wary. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of this stuff is really difficult to measure without really significant imaging technology, right? There's no blood test for dopamine. People just tell you that they can find dopamine in your blood are basically saying you can measure water quality in California by taking samples in Boulder. I think everybody's individually customized. And you got to run the experiment yourself. You can't take anybody's word for it. And I also think getting in the vicinity is often enough for practical benefit.
You know, you mentioned group flow before. That concept really fascinates me, especially some of the things you've uncovered in your research with the Navy SEALs. Can you spend a couple minutes on that?
Sure. Group flow is simply a team, right? In peak performance, functioning at their peak. It's, you know, a great brainstorming session. It's a fourth quarter comeback from football. It is, if you saw the Super Bowl, it is exactly what the Patriots did in that final quarter in action. And the Navy SEALs depend on it. And so in group flow, for a team to perform at their peak, you need sort of high-speed collective decision-making, you know, really high-quality, high-performance improvisation. The SEALs have to, you know, to successfully execute their missions, they really have to drop into group flow. They call it, you know, produce this high, they call it flipping the switch. But they need to kind of drop into group flow and the heightened pattern recognition, the heightened information processing, you know, all the stuff that, you know, is sort of the why behind why do we get access to better information and inspiration and insight in these states. It's because these states jack up all of your kind of information processing machinery. And that really helps a team that's kind of moving through a battle space move more coherently, function more seamlessly, and, you know, really execute. So the SEALs cultivate the state, they screen for it in people who want to become SEALs. Sort of at every level of the training, they try to train it up. They've recently, you know, built Mind Gym to help, you know, using kind of all the tools and tech we've sort of been talking about, plus much, much more to help kind of train people into these states. So they're really active in their pursuit because it's really fundamental. As you know, Rich Davis, who's the man we spent the most time with interviewing, who is a former commander of SEAL Team 6 or DevGru, told us, you know, being able to flip that switch is the real secret to being a SEAL. Mm-hmm.
There was an interesting part in the book with regard to adult development and the impact on executives. Can you talk a little bit about altered That's states and how they directly relate?
That's a great question. So it would be, you know, part of the puzzle is, you know, access to these states, the research consistently shows can help us kind of heal trauma and anxiety. They give us access to heightened inspiration, creativity, collaboration, cooperation, right? But the bigger question was, okay, but do they actually, you know, do they persist over time? Is this lasting development? Is just a short-term peak high that's going to dissipate? You know, those kinds of questions. And a lot has been done on this, but the most compelling stuff. So if you're familiar with Jim Collins's book, Good to Great, kind of the classic business text, at this point, I think everybody's read it. Right. It's just everywhere, right? I ask people, I go to, you know, 1,000 person rooms and I say, who's read Good to Great? And, you know, 990 hands go up. It's just everywhere. And so he talks about the level five leader. This is the kind of the most developed, our uber business leader. These are the people most successfully running our best companies. And they're really perplexing from a psychological perspective. They're very much dichotomies. They're very, 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 very smart and sharp and forward thinking. They're also really humble, very willing to give credit to others, very willing to put the organization and kind of society and culture, you know, ahead of themselves, really interesting dichotomies of people. And but they're very great leaders for businesses. And what Jim Collins says is, we don't know how to get there, right? We have no idea outside of going through deep personal tragedy. We have no idea where level five leaders come from. And what we know from kind of parallel track research into adult development, which is literally how do adults develop over time, that level five leaders correspond to what research out of Harvard, for example, done by Bob Keegan and a lot of others, kind of call the upper reaches of adult development. And so as you develop as an adult, you can, kids go through developmental stages. Every kid goes through the terrible twos. There's no choice. As you get into adulthood, there are more and more and more stages. We'll talk about what happens as you move up the ladder in just a second, but like, it's not mandatory. You can sort of get stuck where you are, or you can move to the next level. And so the upper levels start with like kind of in the self-authoring phase, where you've sort of like broken a little bit free of kind of who society says you should be, and you're making your own way in the world, and you know, leading with passion and purpose and that sort of thing. And above those are these upper levels of development. And as you move up the level, what you gain is widened perspective, the ability to step outside yourself, see problems from multiple perspectives, solve increasingly more complex, so-called wicked problems, empathize greater, both like deeper levels of empathy and wider spheres of empathy, and ultimately all the traits we associate with wisdom. And what Bill Torbert at Boston College discovered in a study of 500 managers is that the managers at the very top of their game, at the very top of the pyramid, the ones performing the best and making the most money, and the ones who had engineered major change for their company over the past 4 years, significant change and brought on significant new revenue, were all in the upper two stages of adult development, right? They all corresponded to level five leaders. But what we've also discovered is we now know how to get there. It turns out that the more access to these kind of ecstatic states of consciousness that we get, as long as we do kind of do the homework along the way, the farther up this developmental period we can move. So one of the ways to kind of push yourself up the developmental pyramid is shutting off normal sense of self and kind of stepping out beyond yourself. Obviously, it widens perspective. And you do that again and again and again. You start to groove new neural pathways, and these new wider perspectives kind of get laid down. And as a result, Torbert found that, you know, as I said, that the people in the top two stages of adult development had 80% of the top positions, and yet they comprised less than 10% of the broader population. Mm-hmm. So we select for this group to run our companies. And, you know, the one liner that we came up with is what all the research consistently shows is that consciousness goes right to the bottom line.
A great example of that. You talked before about mindfulness-based meditation in 44% of the organizations in the U.S. Interesting data that you came across, and I've read more about on Aetna with regard to the bottom line.
Oh, yeah, right? That's a crazy, that I love that. I love this example because it's crazy. So Aetna, they were very early adopters kind of in mindfulness, but they did exactly, you know, what I hope for. They sort of did a giant research problem. They said, okay, we're going to roll out a mindfulness training for all of our employees and we're going to see what happens. And then they went back and measured and they found that, you know, their mindfulness training program is saving them $2,000 per employee in healthcare benefits and earning them $3,000 per employee a year in productivity and creativity benefits.
Which Now that works in Milwaukee.
A mindfulness training program, which by the way is available via an app that I think you can get for like $9.99 a month if you want, or you know,
right.
You could take our advice at FGP and learn how to box breathe, which I think is the most effective, you know, sort of mindfulness that anybody can do, and really good for everything that you want to hit at. You can train your employees up in it, and you're going to literally make $5,000 per employee for something that you can roll out for $10 in 20 minutes a day. Are you kidding?
Yeah, that message plays anywhere. Well, Stephen, congratulations on all the success with Stealing Fire and the Flow Genome Project. And thanks for being a part of Growth Minded Milwaukee.
Hey, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
So that was my conversation with Stephen Kotler. To learn more, you can check out stephenkotler.com or flowgenomeproject.com. And to learn more about his most recent book, check out stealingfirebook.com. Growth Minded Milwaukee is powered by the WTMJ mobile platform. You can find it on the WTMJ website or mobile app. The show is also available on iTunes, SoundCloud, and YouTube. Be sure to subscribe to the show. And as always, thanks for listening. Until next time, enjoy your week.